Welcome to the Bad Apples. This is season 00 of season 4. My name is Quatu. I'm your friendly host. This episode, actually, I recorded a lot in this episode, enough for two episodes, so I'm probably going to split it up into two episodes. But I can't really tell what is going to go into this episode until I edit it, so I have no idea what I'm going to talk about in this episode. But in the next two episodes, I'm going to be covering a new application called Webcam, with a K. I'm going to be talking about QTractor. I'm going to be talking about the Blender project idea that I had. I'll be talking about, I'll be doing listener feedback. I give a coffee tip, and I don't remember what else I talk about, but those are some of the things that I'll be talking about. So stay tuned. Fun with your /etsy/hosts file. The /etsy/hosts file, if you do a man space hosts, has a little man page on it, explaining pretty much what it does, and it explains it pretty well. But I'm going to explain it to you in the way that I used it, have been using it lately. First of all, /etsy/hosts. It's just a dot, it's a text file, and what it is a static lookup table for host names, meaning that your /etsy/hosts will supersede, or even I guess precede, any DNS lookup that your system does for access to a network. So here's the setup. Well, that was the setup. Here was what I was going through, and this is how I sort of rediscovered /etsy/hosts. And I say rediscovered because I'd already heard about it on Hacker Public Radio, but I had no clue really what they were talking about. I just thought it was interesting, but I didn't know the practical application. So the practical application of it for me was that I was typing in the IP address of the machine that I wanted to secure copy something over to every time I wanted to secure copy something. And after a while, I was trying to use bash variables to make that a little bit quicker and everything, and that kind of helped, but it still seemed a little bit wrong to me. So I knew there was another way to do it. So instead of just saying, SCP foobar.txt to gort at 192.168.34.2:/home/gort/desktop every time I wanted to copy something, I figured there should be a way that I don't have to remember the IP address of that particular machine. And sure enough, it is in the /etsy/hosts file. That's the way to get around this. So first what I did was I set the host name of the computer. So instead of whatever it was, I made sure that Gort's computer was, if I typed in host name, that it returned Gort. Did that work? No. What happened then was that every time I typed in SCP whatever.txt gort at gortbox.com/home/gort/desktop, it would try to go onto the internet and SCP something to something called gortbox.com. And the way I found out that it was trying to do this was that I went to I just pinged on my network gortbox. And it was returning pings. And at first I thought, oh, cool, so it's actually seeing Gortbox. Well, no, not really, because if I looked who the pings were from, it was coming from hit-nxdomain.opendns.com. I'm using OpenDNS as my DNS lookup server and my name server. So what it's doing is it's trying to ping something called Gortbox.com, and instead it's going, through OpenDNS to that page that OpenDNS brings up every time you mistype something or you type something in that it doesn't know. It brings up kind of a suggested hits page. So that's what I was pinging on accident. So obviously there needed to be some way to tell my computer that gortbox.com exists on my local network, and don't go out to the DNS, the name server, to look it up, because it's something that I made up, and it is something that that exists here on my local network. Let me take a sip of my coffee. Alright, so the way to do this the easiest way to do all of this is, first you want to get into your router, your router's firmware, whatever, you know, the little web interface that they always send out. I've had a Belkin, a Netgear, and a TrendNet router so far, and all three of them have had this kind of option where you can add a static IP list for all of the devices that are usually on your network. So let's say I've got my computer, I've got Gort's computer, I've got my Nokia, let's say, and all of those three things in my apartment are always going to be on the network, and I know that. So what I can do is tell my router to assign slackbox 192.168.34.1 every single time, and it will know that it's slackbox because it will have a MAC address that it will read. That's how logical IP addressing works. It looks at the physical address and gives it a logical address. And I can tell it to look at Gortbox's IP address and give it, a MAC address and give it a certain IP address, 192.168.34.2, and then my Nokia. Now, in real life, honestly, I could probably just remember the IP addresses just from that, I imagine, if it was just three devices. But in real life, it's not just three devices. It's a couple of different computers. It's a couple of different devices. It's a multimedia device. It's a lot of different things on this network that I don't want to have to keep in my head which one got which IP address. So go into your router and see if there's an option to add like a static IP and MAC address list. And there should be. It's always in some different place, but if you look around, you should be able to find it. So now what you need to do is set the host name for each computer. And that is done just in your command line on the computer that we're talking about. So let's say I'm over I'll go over to Gortbox, and of course I don't really have to go over to Gortbox. I'm sitting here in front of my computer, so I'll just SSH into Gort at 192.168.34.2, or was it 3? See, this is why I don't like to have to remember this stuff. It's there. And then you just tell it, okay, I'm going to SU, so that I'm root, and then I'm going to say hostname space Gortbox. And now I'm going to set the domain name, and I do that via domain name space foobar.com. So now I've got a hostname on that thing as Gortbox, and I've got domain name as foobar. And I'm going to do the same thing for each device on my network. I'll call my Nokia, and domain name is foobar.com. I will call my main computer here in front of me, Clatoobox, domain name foobar.com, and then I've got Slackbox, foobar.com, Debianbox, foobar.com. So I've got lots of different computers. I can name it anything I want. They all need to have the same domain name, but I can name each one anything that I want so that I remember which computer I want to send it to. I can easily think, okay, that computer's name is so-and-so. And you can do this by, who uses this computer most. Or just if you name your computers, you can just give it a name, whatever. Now, once you've done that, you need to start adding the IP addresses that have been assigned to these computers to your /etc/host. And to do that, again, you're going to want to be root. So su, put in your password, or sudo, and then do this command. And then echo space single quote 192.168.34.1, for instance, space, let's say, slackbox.foobar.com, space, slackbox, close single quote, space, greater than, space, /etc/hosts. So what we're doing is we're echoing the IP address, the full host name and domain name of the computer that's a destination for, and then we're just giving the host name, the short name, I guess we could call it, and then we're appending it to etc hosts. So once again, that would be echo space single quote 192.168.34.1 space slackbox.foobar.com space slackbox, close the single quote, and then space, and then two greater than signs, because that appends it to the file, and then you say space /etc/hosts. And because you're root, it will allow you to do that, and if you were to do a /etc/hosts, you would see now your /etc/hosts file, and sure enough, at the bottom of that file would be the line that you just now added. And so you want to do that for each device on your network. So if I've got Slackbox, and then maybe I need to do Clatoobox, so I do echo space single quote 192.168.34.2 space clatoobox.foobar.com space clatoobox single close single quote greater than etc hosts. And I would do that for every single device. Now, once you're done with that, I would have to do that on each computer that I want this to work. So if I'm sometimes sitting at Cloud2Box and I want to be able to refer to every machine just by their little nickname, then I need to have that those lines in my /etc/hosts file. But then if one day I decide to start using Gortbox as my main computer or something, and I want to refer to Cloud2Box by its short name, then I would need to have those lines in Gorts/etc/hosts file as well. So what you might want to do, if you're doing this to a lot of devices, and this is what I did, is make a separate text file of all the devices and all the little IP addresses and stuff like that, and then just go to each computer and cat that text file to the end of the /etc/hosts on each computer. And that's just less typing, basically, because then you've only typed your little list once, and then you just secure copy it over to each device and cat it to the end of the /etc/hosts file. There might even be a more efficient way to do it than that. I couldn't think of a way, so that's what I did, and it worked out. But anyway, once you've done that on one of your computers, or all of your computers, whichever you want, you can now secure copy stuff or SSH over to a machine simply by referring to its little short name. So if I wanted to say SCP space whatever.txt space cloud2@slackbox:\home/cloud2/desktop. Now it's going to do that, and I don't have to remember the IP address ever again. Don't have to think about the IP address. I just know that the computer I want to send something over to is the Slack box, and that's that. It's a lot easier to remember short names like that for me than IP addresses. And the way that we're doing it, obviously, is because the first place the computer checks is /etc/hosts. And if it finds the IP address there, it resolves it locally, rather than going out to the interwebs to do it. What does this mean? Well, according to a Hacker Public Radio episode that I heard some time ago, I think it was by Rowan Golfer, but it could have been by someone else. I could be wrong. I can't find it. I was looking for it last night, and I don't remember what it was called, but I think it was Rowan Golfer. Certainly, he was the one who turned me on to OpenDNS, so I think he was also talking about the /etc/hosts. But either way, somebody on Hacker Public Radio was talking about using this as a kind of, I hate to say censorship, but a kind of way to keep certain URLs from being resolved by the big DNS server in the sky. For instance, let's say we want, anytime someone's on my computer and they type in, Microsoft.com, I want it to take them to fedoraproject.org. That would be a fair enough. No reason to resolve Microsoft.com on the World Wide Web. Might as well just resolve it here locally and have it resolved to something sensible. All I would have to do there is I would have to find out the server address of Microsoft.com, where it's hosted. And that would be, if I go into my terminal, I would just type in host:\Microsoft.com. And it returns a couple of different IP addresses. Microsoft.com has the address 207.46.232.182 and 207.46.197.32. And the mail is handled by mail.global.frontbridge.com. Okay, well, I don't really need the last line, but I do need those two IP addresses. So it's the 207.46.232.182 and 207.46.192.32 that I care about. So what I would do is, again, I would become root, SU, password, and then echo, space, single quote, 207.46.232.182, space, fedoraproject.org, space, Microsoft, close, single quote, space, > space, /etc/hosts. So that would cause, anytime anyone typed in www.microsoft.com, it would go to fedoraproject.org. Now I would want to echo the other IP address in there too. And you can try this right away. I mean, you can echo something into your etc/hosts. No restart or reboot required. Just open up Firefox and type in microsoft.com. It works like a charm. Obviously, the potential for practical jokes here is endless, but at the same time, it's also really a way to bypass DNS servers, which would be kind of weird if, for instance, microsoft.com changed its server. Like, if they decided to change hosts and changed the actual IP address of where they're hosted, then your little filter will no longer work, because now Microsoft.com is no longer married to that IP address. But it's got a certain practical aspect to it as well. So that's about all I've got on hosts, on /etc/hosts. It's a really handy file. It's worth getting to know a little bit better, and it's worth using if you're going to be kind of jockeying files around on your network a lot. It's a lot easier to know little nicknames for your computers than their IP addresses, and could come in handy to bypass DNS as well, whatever you need it to do. So have fun with /etc/hosts. Look up the Hacker Public Radio episode by Rowing Golfer. Again, I don't know if it's the one that I'm thinking of, but he's got a couple of good episodes. Might as well listen to them. I'm pretty sure it was him that mentioned the /etc/hosts thing. And you can also listen to my, I think, second Hacker Public Radio on SSH, where I talk about SSH keys and using SSH keys so that you don't have to type in the password all the time. So listen to that when you get a chance to. That's something else that will kind of smooth your workflow over your network a little bit. So have fun with all that. Good luck. In my very scattered attempt to learn how to program, I've recently been reading a book called Practical Programming, I think is what it's called. No, I'm sorry. It's called simply Learn to Program. But it is it's in a series of books called the Pragmatic Programmer. And it's actually a really good book. It's by a guy named Chris Pine. It just so happens, and I didn't even realize this, but at the bottom of the front cover it does say that it's the Facets of Ruby series. So I had no idea that it was going to be on Ruby, but it turns out that it is, but that's fine. It turns out to be a really good book. Ruby turns out to be a neat little language, I think. Not that I have that much to compare it to, but it's kind of cool. It's a slim book. It's not that terribly thick, but it definitely is a neat book. So if you're looking to kind of get into programming and stuff, you could do worse than picking up this particular book. Again, it's Learn to Program, second edition by Chris Pine, and it's part of the Pragmatic Programmer series, and for the life of me, I do not know who the publisher is. I think it's called The Pragmatic Bookshelf. That's what it seems to, yeah, The Pragmatic Bookshelf. So, I haven't done anything incredible programming-wise yet, and I don't know if I'll stick with Ruby, but it's definitely a good place to kind of start out with. Now, it just so happens that I was looking around on kde-apps.org the other day, and I was looking specifically for a webcam application, because there's obviously the GNOME little application called Cheese, and that was working for me fine. I mean, I didn't really use my webcam that frequently anyway, but I just wanted to see what else was out there, something natively cute, maybe, just for kicks. I mean, no problem with Cheese whatsoever. Cheese was working great, a great little application. I have no complaints about it whatsoever. But I was just curious as to whether there was something more cute-centric for the webcam, just for kicks. Turns out there is. It's called Webcam, but guess what? It's spelled with a K. That's right, it's Webcam with a K. And if you Google search it, plus kde-apps.org, or just go to kde-apps.org and search for search for webcam with a K. And there is this, it's very early in its life from what I can tell, but the neat thing about it, aside from being native cute for, is that it was written in Ruby, which is kind of neat to me, because I've always thought of Ruby as a web site language, and I know it was probably never a website language until, I don't know, Ruby on Rails or something. I don't really know much about Ruby, but I didn't know that you could do Ruby cute. You know, I just didn't know there was that option, and there apparently is, so it's kind of cool. But the webcam application is a nice little application. It doesn't have any of the funky effects that I never used anyway, that Cheese has or Photo Booth has. It's just a webcam interface, but it works. It does what it is designed to do quite well, and it doesn't have the video setting, the video option that Cheese has. So that's kind of that's one reason not to use this, I guess. But it's got a full screen mode, and it's a clean little app. There's nothing. It's all very very obvious how to use it and stuff like that. All the source code, of course, is on kde-apps.org. So if you want to look through the source code, you can. In fact, if you're running Fedora, you'll have to compile it from source anyway, because I think he packages it for Ubuntu only. If that even, actually, I don't really remember if he even has that. Might just be all from source. But it was a pretty easy compilation. It compiles fine. You'll need to make sure that all the dependencies are satisfied, and there are quite a few dependencies, and I'm pretty sure that initially I didn't have one of the dependencies installed, so I was pulling out my hair a little bit, and finally I I reread the list and saw that I had missed one. So really just make sure that you got everything satisfied and then compile it as instructed on kde-apps.org and in the install me, text file in the source code. And it should compile without really any problem. And it works really well. It's a cool little app written in Ruby and Qt 4. So check it out if you're looking for a Qt-based webcam application that does not do video. I think it's time for a coffee break, but before I do the coffee break, I'm going to give you a coffee tip, because this is something I've been doing lately. I should really probably send this into Reader's Digest or something, but I'm just giving it away to you. If you've got an espresso machine, which I recently acquired, I had been without one for years, but I recently got one again, and it was quite nice. So if you have one, and you're sitting around your apartment, and you want to make a single serving cup of coffee, and you also want to be green, and you don't want to waste a filter, you can use your espresso machine in this manner. Take the coffee and only fill up the little coffee container in the espresso machine, the coffee basket, halfway, so that it's destined to make, a double shot espresso. But then fill up the water to the four shot line. So you've got, twice as much water as you should have for a proper double shot espresso, right? And then proceed and, just have it make coffee. It will make, obviously, what basically boils down to being a cafe Americano, because it's just an espresso with extra water added, and it's just quite good. If you like Cafe Americano, and if you are in need of a single serving cup of coffee, this is a great way to go. It makes a quick little cup of coffee for you. It's really, really good. Like I say, it saves you on wasting a filter in a regular coffee maker, and I don't know, I love Cafe Americano, so I mean, I think it tastes great. So there's my coffee tip for you. And now let's have a coffee break.
Our story begins here, with coffee. Its flavor caught in the closed fist of a bean, freed then by the grinding mills in an endless cascade, brewed into a beverage that is consumed in the hundreds of millions of cupfuls each day. In this beverage that has become so much a part of our lives, there is a background, a tradition that reaches deeply into the culture of many lands.
Okay, the internets are both failing and succeeding all at the same time, depending on what site you go to. This is just kind of a rant about some things going on the internet lately. I'm not going to make it too long, I hope, but you know how rants get. So the internet was a place where you could go and get all kinds of information at one point, right? This is still true, but sometimes it's not completely accessible. If I open up a site in eLinks, for instance, and all I see is a blank page with you don't have Flash installed or something like that, that's a problem. Or JavaScript or whatever fancy eye candy related thing that a site might have. That's a problem for me, and it's a problem for people who don't want to use X or can't see to use X. They need to access this stuff with text only. And since the internet is historically, it was very, very text-based, it still is very text-based in that it's a whole bunch of HTML documents floating around, it seems to me like it'd be a really good idea to maintain the text-only option on the internet. That's kind of my standard thing about the internet, and I've said it before, and I'll keep believing it, because I know that sometimes I don't have X started, and I know that sometimes people that I know either don't or almost can't have X started. They wouldn't be able to see it if they had it started, so why start it? So it's just text is important. Internet, if it's going to continue to be the information superhighway that it once was, needs to stay at least with a text alternative to all the pages being created out there. Funny thing about the internet too is that a lot of sites are kind of dependent upon, a lot of official sites are dependent upon just some random person, whoever was commissioned to, build that website. And what I'm talking about here is a website that I had found on a government page on, I think it was in Maryland because I was looking up for a friend who didn't really use the internet that much, but they needed to know the name of their state representative or something like that. So I went to this random site, maryland.gov something, and lo and behold, on this site, which clearly hadn't been updated that recently, I guess, but, I mean, you know, still recently enough. But sure enough, on this site, it said that this site required or worked best on Internet Explorer. Now, I've never seen a site really that works best on Internet Explorer. I mean, the site should just work, right? So I just because I was on vacation at the time and I had the opportunity to do this, I emailed the webmaster and told them that that I thought it was quite odd that a government site should be promoting the browser of a certain company. And I asked them why they were recommending Internet Explorer over something like Firefox, etc. To my surprise, a couple of days later, they actually wrote back, and they said, or she said, the webmaster, she said that she was by no means recommending Internet Explorer, that message had been left on there from, you know, years ago, when apparently their site did work best in Microsoft's Internet Explorer. And I imagine this is because they probably did the site in, like, Front Page or something. But she actually removed the notice. Like, I went back to the page, and it was gone. There was no reference of what browser to use at all, which impressed me quite a bit, because, I don't know, I've never gotten any kind of positive feedback about a random complaint like that before, but there you go. Now some random government site in Maryland is not recommending Internet Explorer anymore. Whether you need to take your time to email webmasters about these kinds of references or not is entirely up to you. I don't think I'll probably do it again unless I'm just bored, you know. I mean, that's kind of why I did it in the first place, because I was on sort of a vacation and I had the opportunity to just send out a random email like that, so I did it. But that was kind of neat. But it was also kind of annoying that such a reference was made at all. Obviously, especially on a government site, something like that should not appear, because there's just no way to get Internet Explorer on certain platforms at this point, and certainly no reason to. Another place where the internets have failed fairly well, and I've talked about Apple sites on my own. You know, I'll try to log into a particular site owned by Apple, and it will tell me that I need Firefox, you know, 2 or greater installed, and I'll do an about on Firefox, and sure enough, it's like Firefox 3. It just doesn't like my OS. Randy knows, one of the guys who does Juiced Penguin, sent me a screenshot at one point of I think it was GoDaddy. Their online sort of interface to build your site wouldn't recognize that he was running Firefox. Again, it was obvious that he was. The screenshot has both the web interface and his About Firefox window open, clearly running Firefox 3.0.something, and the site saying that, you know, he needs such and such installed. Just doesn't like his OS. I don't know if he tried a user agent switcher trick or anything, but my gut feeling is that wouldn't have worked anyway. So these are issues that I think need to be kept in mind. I mean, it's not like I'm going to go out and start emailing every company that, you know, isn't compliant with whatever W3 ordinance says that, you know, you have to do a user agent check this way, or you have to actually recognize when someone's running Firefox 3, you know. I mean, I don't know the specifics of that kind of thing anyway. Obviously, they're not doing things within spec, quote-unquote, because I'm on Linux, and I'm running a browser, and I'm going to a website, and that right there should work. And when it doesn't work, yeah, it's really annoying, and it goes against a lot of what the internets are supposed to kind of be about. So keep that in mind if you're designing your own site, at least, that, you know, you need text alternatives, you need cross-compatibility, and that's important because that's what the internet used to be about, and it's what it needs to continue to be about. The more segmented it becomes, really, the less relevant it's going to be, and that's not really a whole lot of fun. So that's random complaints about random sites that you'll probably never even go to anyway, but there you go. People need to keep that in mind, hopefully, you know, work toward more compliant websites. I'm probably preaching to the choir here, so I'm not really sure what the point of this is, but one place that the internets are not failing, and they're succeeding, is Myth TV Cast. If you have not yet heard of Myth TV Cast, it is a podcast coming out, or that has come out now. They've got their first episode out by Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show and Dan, and they are, sure enough, releasing their episodes in AUG only. Yes, incredibly enough, AUG only. I think it's really cool, not only because, I was the first AUG-only podcast that I'm aware of, and then Linux Cranks went AUG-only, so it's really neat to see people jumping on this bandwagon. It's just really great to see AUG being pushed forward as a viable format. I just think it's really cool. I hope they stick with it. I hope they don't. I mean, they might very well get complaints from people. You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I know that Linux Cranks got a lot of complaints from people when they went AUG-only. I got zero complaints, but then I only have 25, 28, whatever, listeners. So Miss TV Cast, they might get some complaints. I hope they stick with the AUG-only format. I just think it's really neat. I think it's quite cool that they're doing that, and very impressive. And I congratulate them on both the new show, which promises to be very cool, as well as the AUG-only format. And the website for that show is mythtvcast.com, so check that out. Q-Tractor. This is an application that I saw come through one of my RSS feeds. It had a new release, I think it was .4.1, something like that. So it's still considered, according to the author, an alpha application, although it feels to me like a beta. It does, but anyway, it's called Q-Tractor, and this is an audio application, a lot like Ardour. So if you're looking for an application that is going to sequence audio strips together, allow you to insert plugins, mix things around, non-destructive editing. Yes, you can use Ardour, or you can try Q-Tractor, which is a Qt4 application written in C++, and is just a fantastic, really impressive, surprisingly great application. I downloaded it, I compiled it. Again, I think you have to do it from source unless you're on Ubuntu. I think they've got a package for Ubuntu, although I don't know if it'll be completely up to date. It might not be 4.1, you know, it might be 0.4 or something like that. But if you just download the source and compile this, it's a pretty easy compile. I didn't have any problems with it. You just, and by the way, if you don't know how to compile software, there's an episode that I did, I think, in the second season where I kind of go over compiling software, and I did it live in front of a studio audience. Well, not really, but I did do it live. I just randomly chose something to compile, and it compiles really well, you know, so it should bring you a little bit of confidence if you're not someone who compiles software a whole lot, so just give it a shot. But basically all you do is you download Q-Tractor and you do the usual, you know, well, what I do is tar space XZF space Q-Tractor -0.4 and then just tab and it'll finish it. And then I'm going to change directory into Q-Tractor if it will let me go. And now I'm going to list. And sure enough, there's a file in here called install. So if I just left space install, all caps, it tells me exactly what I need to do in order to compile this thing. And the way that I need to do it is I cd into the directory. I do a .configure, and that will configure it. It will take a while. And then I type make to compile the program, and then I become root, and I do make install. And that is indeed all I had to do. I wasn't sure if I had to use CMake or anything like that, but for this one, no, you don't. Once it's compiled, give it a moment, and it'll show up in your KDE menu automatically. Or if you want to just launch it from your terminal, you can do that as well. It's just a really nice application. It's a nice looking application. It's got a great manual. They claim it's out of date, although, I mean, it looks really good to me. And it's one of those manuals that doesn't just, you know, kind of talk about how to do simple things within your project. It's really a manual that talks a lot about Linux audio in general. So you actually learn quite a bit just from reading this manual. You learn quite a bit about Linux audio and the way that it interfaces with, you know, different applications interface with each other, etc., etc. So you might want to take a look at that. The application itself, I mean, it looks pretty familiar in terms of audio editing software. On the left, you've got your track list. In the middle, you've got the actual space, the workspace where you're going to put all your tracks and things like that. And then on the right, the one thing that you have that is unique, which actually I like a lot, you've got this thing, you've got sort of a file list, which I really think is a great idea. So you've got kind of a, what I would call, from a video editor standpoint, my bin. And that's where I can put all my little audio files or all my samples or all the tracks that I've recorded. And then all I need to do to get them over into my middle section is I click on the file, and I drag it over. Simple as that. Now, one thing you have to keep in mind is the project setting. They don't make it terribly obvious, but it's in the File menu. If you go down to Properties or hit F2, that will give you the properties of the entire session of your whole workspace. So when I first did this, I added my files, which are recorded at a ridiculous like 8,000 sample rate, 8,000 hertz sample rate, and that's obviously pretty bad. But the default sample rate of QTractor's workspace was 4,800, which is pretty high sample rate, and that's a good thing. But anything that you play back, if it was recorded at 8,000 and you're playing it back at 4,800, you've got problems. Now, for some reason, and this might be something that they need to implement later, for some reason I can't set the sample rate on QTractor anything but 4,800. So I had to go back with like SOX and upsample all of my clips. That's not great. It's not a huge problem either. I mean, it's a feature they're going to implement once they're out of alpha stage, you know, or in a later alpha stage. So that's not a big deal considering where this application is. But the really nice thing is this thing is so stable. So you can add all your audio files to this. You can throw them in the middle portion of the application. It creates its own track for you. You don't have to have a pre-existing track to add an audio segment. And then you can start moving all the audio segments around. If you go up to View, the View menu, you've got a mixer available. It's also married to the F9 key and keyboard shortcuts. If you scroll through here, here's all the different actions that you've got available to you within QTractor. And one of the functions is Split. And so I married Split just to the S key. No Control, no Alt, just S, the letter S. If I press the letter S, it will split an audio region for me. Just like in Ardour, there's sort of an editing playhead, and then there's the actual play playhead. So the editing playheads are blue, and you can use those to select segments and things like that. The red playhead is the one that kind of moves around when you hit play, and it's also the one that's going to act as your splicing tool. I hate that model of doing things using a playhead as splicer and player and all these other things. I prefer to have different tools. Give me a razor blade tool. Audacity doesn't do it. This doesn't do it. Ardour doesn't do it. I don't know what the deal is, but every other application, like in the proprietary professional world that I've used, features, you know, tools like a razor blade tool or a scissor tool. So if someone would do that, that would be really nifty. But until I learn C++, it's not like I'm going to be able to implement any of these ideas myself. So that's not a big deal. It's certainly not a deal breaker. So it's a really cool editing application. Certain things are missing. There are all the basic needs of editing are here from what they're saying, or from what he's saying. I think it's really just one developer working on this, which blows my mind. But from what he says, he's going to be implementing, you know, a little bit more, obviously, or a lot more. So I look forward to the continued development of this application. What really, really pleased me, to be honest, was just the stability of the application and the fact that it, quote-unquote, just worked. It did just work. I compiled it. I started it up. It recognized my inputs automatically. It recognized my outputs automatically. I was thoroughly impressed, really, really impressed. And it's stable. It does exactly what I need it to do, aside from, like, amplifying it without a separate plugin, things like that. But overall, I mean, it's a fantastic looking application, and it really, really functions really, really well. Keep in mind the View menu, that's got all your different little tools that you've got, like connections, the mixer, the message, the file bin, things like that. You've got your shortcuts that you're really going to need shortcuts for this, because they only assign a few of them, and there are certain things that, you know, really need shortcuts, like splitting and muting and soloing. But overall, I mean, I'm amazed at the application itself. I'm probably going to contact this developer to see if I can get him on the show, because this is an exciting project for lots of different reasons. So yeah, check it out. It's called QTractor. That's QTRACTOR. It will do audio and MIDI. They're working on, from what I understand, more of a tracking functionality for MIDI. They already have some of that, but I don't think it's exactly where they want it to be. I think it's sort of called a piano roll. That's what CyberCod on IRC was calling it. I could be wrong, but I think this is what he's looking for, a piano roll function, where you can kind of get into a matrix editor, is what I would have called it from the applications that I'm used to, and kind of do little dots for each MIDI event that you want to occur, and it will play each MIDI event represented like by little dots and lines and things like that. I think that's what he's looking for, so I'm gonna definitely tell him about it, because I know a couple of people have been asking about an application that does that, that doesn't take, you know, years to learn. And QTractor's interface is such that it's really, really intuitive. And, you know, I mean, typically speaking, I love new applications. You know, I love downloading them. I love getting to know them. I really do. I love a good application. But one thing that, after a while, you know, when you're doing things like, when you're doing freelance work and you're studying, this and that, you know, you get a new application, and you kind of start to dread having to learn it, because you're like, well, I know how an application like this would have worked on my old computing platform. I don't know how this one's going to work. Can I really sit here and afford to learn a completely new application? You know, it becomes a bit of a chore sometimes, depending on what your life is otherwise occupied with. So to open up QTractor and basically to have figured it out in 15 seconds, well, okay, maybe 1 minute, just by doing a couple of right clicks and like looking through the menus, that to me is a very impressive thing. Not to be underestimated, not to be underappreciated. I think that that's a huge, important thing for this application. A great, great trait to have, you know, because this is an application that is an audio editor and could potentially be very obtuse, even to someone familiar with audio editing applications. But instead, it just turns out to be really very user-friendly, very powerful, and very, very stable. All of those things. So I personally am very impressed, and hope that, you know, they'll continue to developer will continue to develop it, and hopefully it'll keep being a great application, and potentially at some point, you know, I mean, this is going to be, it's going to be everything from Logic Pro or Cubase for Linux, on down to GarageBand for Linux. It's really a great application. Really enjoying it. Congratulations, developer. Well, folks, that's about all I've got for you. This has been episode 00, season 4. Frankly, I've recorded so much at this point that this might turn into 2 episodes, so we'll see. Sorry if certain things don't make sense, if I start referring to things that I mentioned earlier in this episode and didn't, then that's why, because I had to edit things more than I thought, so there might be 2 episodes coming from this. But yeah, so if you need to reach me, I'm klaatu@hackerpublicradio.com or klaatu@thelinuxcranks.info. Otherwise, find me in IRC when I can get there, on Freenode at Linux Cranks. That's usually where I am. Sometimes I'm elsewhere as well, but I'm almost always in Linux Cranks. I'm trying to represent, you know what I'm saying? So that's it. That's the show. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Stuff coming up.